its eye and in one smooth motion snatched at it, extending his arm and opening his fist to let fly what it had plucked. Not the eye itself, but some essence of his glance went from the palm like a ball trailing smoke. Gentle reached for the mischief to drag it out of the sway's path, but his hand fell inches short of Pye's back, and as he reached again the sway struck. The fluttering blade dropped from the mischief's hand, as it was thrown backwards by the impact, its gaze fixed on Gentle as it fell into his arms. The momentum carried them both to the ground, but Gentle was quick to roll from under the mischief's weight and put his hand to his mouth to defend them with a pneuma. Sartori was already retreating into the smoke, however, on his face a look that would vex Gentle for many days and nights to come. There was more distress in it than triumph, more sorrow than rage. "Who will reconcile us now?" he said. And then he was gone into the murk, as though he had mastery of the smoke and had pulled it around him to duck away behind its folds. Gentle didn't give chase, but went back to the mischief, lying where it had fallen. He knelt beside it.
"Who was he?"
Pye said.
"Something I made," Gentle said, "when I was a maestro."
"Another Sartori?" Pye said.
"Yes."
"Then go after him. Kill him. Those creatures are the most..."
"Later."
"Before he escapes."
"He can't escape, lover. There's no way he can go. I won't find him."
Pye's hands were clutching at the place in mid-chest where Sartori's malice had struck.
"Let me see," Gentle said,
drawing Pye's fingers away and tearing at the mischief's shirt. The wound was a stain on its flesh, black at the centre and fading to a pustular yellow at its edges.
"Where's Huzza?"
Pye asked him, breath laboured.
"She's dead," Gentle replied. "She was murdered by a Nolyanak."
"So much death," Pye said. "It blinded me. I would have killed you and not even known I'd done it."
"We're not going to talk about death," Gentle said. "We're going to find some way of healing you."
"There's more urgent business than that," Pye said. "I came to kill the Autark."
"No, Pye."
"That was the judgment," Pye insisted. "But now I can't finish it. Will you do it for me?"
Gentle put his hand beneath the mischief's head and raised Pye up.
"I can't do that," he said.
"Why not? You could do it with a breath."
"No, Pye. I'd be killing myself."
"What?"
The mischief stared up at Gentle, baffled. But its puzzlement was short-lived. Before Gentle had time to explain, Pye let out a long, sorrowful sigh in the shape of three soft words.
"Oh, my lord."
"I found him in the pivot tower. I didn't believe it at first."
"The Autark Sartori,"
Pye said, as if trying the words for their music. Then, its voice a dirge, it said,
"It has a ring."
"You knew I was a maestro all along, didn't you?"
"Of course."
"But you didn't tell me."
"I got as close as I dared, but I had sworn an oath never to remind you of who you were."
"Who made you swear that oath?"
"You did, maestro. You were in pain, and you wanted to forget your suffering."
"How did I come to forget?"
"A simple fate."
"Your doing?"
Pye nodded.
"I was your servant in that as in everything. I swore an oath that when it was done, when the past was hidden away, I would never show it to you again. And oaths don't decay."
"But you kept hoping I'd ask the right questions."
"Yes."
"And invite the memory back in."
"Yes." "And you came close."
"In my care. And in the mountains."
"But never close enough to free me from my responsibility. I had to keep my silence."
"Well, it's broken now, my friend. When you're healed..."
"No, maestro," Pye said. "A wound like this can't be healed."
"It can and will,"
Gentle said, not willing to countenance the thought of failure. He remembered Nicetomas's talk of the Dirther's encampment on the margin of the Second and First Dominions, where she'd said Esterbrook had been taken. Miracles of healing were possible there, she'd boasted.
"We're going to make quite a journey, my friend," he said. starting to lift the mastiff up.
"Why break your back?" it said to him. "Let's say our farewells here."
"I'm not saying goodbye to you, here or anywhere," Gentle said. "Now put your arms around me, lover. We've got a long way to go together yet."
Chapter 3 1 The comet's ascent into the heavens above Isordrex, and the light it shed upon the city's streets, didn't shame the atrocities there into hiding or cessation. Quite the other way around. The city was ruled by ruin now, and its court was everywhere, celebrating the enthronement, parading its emblems, the luckiest already dead, and rehearsing its rites in preparation for a long and inglorious reign. Children wore ash today and carried their parents' heads like censers, still smoking from the fires where they'd been found. Dogs had the freedom of the city and devoured their masters without fear of punishment. The carrion birds Sartori had once tempted off the desert winds to feed on bad meat were gathered on the streets in garrulous hordes to dine on the men and women who'd gossiped there the day before. There were those survivors, of course, who clung to the dream of order and banded together to do what they could under the new regime, digging through the rubble in the hope of finding survivors, dousing fires in buildings that were whole enough to save, giving succour to the grieving and quick dispatch for those too wounded to bear another breath. But they were easily outnumbered by the souls whose faith in sanity had been shattered and met the comet's eye with dissolution in their hearts. By mid-morning, when Gentle and Pye reached the gate that led out of the city into the desert, many of those who'd begun the day determined to preserve something from this calamity had given up and were leaving while they still had their lives. The exodus that would empty Isordrex of much of its population within half a week had begun. Beyond the vague instruction gleaned from Nicetomas that the encampment to which Esterbrook had been taken lay in the desert at the limits of this dominion, Gentle was travelling blind. He'd hoped to find somebody along the way to give him some better directions, but he encountered nobody who looked fit enough, mentally or physically, to lend him assistance. He'd bound the hand he'd wounded, beating down the door of the pivot tower as best he could before leaving the palace. The stab wound he'd sustained when Hazar had been snatched and the cut the mistiff's ribbon blade had opened were slight enough to cause him little discomfort. His body, possessed of a maestro's resilience, had survived 3 times a natural human span without significant deterioration, and it was quick to begin the process of mending itself now. The same could not be said for Pai O'Par's wounded frame. Sartori's sway was venomous, draining the mistiff's strength and consciousness. By the time Gentle left the city, the mistiff was barely able to move its legs, obliging Gentle to half-hoist it up beside him. He only hoped they found some means of transport before too long, or this journey would be over before it was begun. There was little chance of hitching a ride with any of their fellow refugees. Most were on foot, and those who had transport, carts, cars, runty mules, were already laden with passengers. Several overburdened vehicles had given up the ghost within sight of the city gates, and those who'd paid for their ride were arguing on the roadside. But most of the travellers went on their way with an eerie hush, barely raising their eyes from the road a few feet in front of them, at least until they reached the spot where that road divided. Here a bottleneck had been created, as people milled around, deciding on which of the 3 routes available to them they were going to take. Straight ahead, though a considerable distance from the crossroads, lay a mountain range as impressive as the Jokalela. The road to the left led off into greener terrain, and not surprisingly, perhaps, this was the most favoured way. The least favoured, and for Gentle's purposes the most promising, was the road that lay to the right. It was dusty and badly laid, the terrain it wound through the least lush and therefore the most likely to deteriorate into desert. But he knew from his months in the Dominions that the terrain could change considerably within the space of a few miles, and that perhaps out of sight along this road lay verdant pastures, while the track behind him could just as easily lead into a wilderness. While he was standing in the mill of travellers, debating with himself, he heard a high-pitched voice, and peering through the dust, caught sight of a small fellow, young, spectacled, bare-chested and bald, making his way towards him, arms raised.
"Mr. Zacharias! Mr. Zacharias!"
He knew the face, but from precisely where he couldn't recall, nor could he put a name to it. But the man, perhaps used to being only half-remembered, was quick to supply the information.
"Floccus Dedo," he said. "You remember?"
Now he did. This was Nicetomas's comrade-in-arms. Floccus snatched off his glasses and peered at Pi.
"Your lady friend looks sick," he said.
"It's not a she. It's a mischief."
"Sorry, sorry,"
Floccus said, slipping his spectacles back on and blinking violently.
"My error. Sex was never my strong point. Is it very sick?"
"I'm afraid so."
"Is Nikkei with you?"
Floccus said, peering around.
"Don't tell me she's gone on ahead. I told her I was going to wait for her here if we got separated."
"She won't be coming, Floccus," Gentle said.
"Why in the high or not?"
"I'm afraid she's dead."
Dado's nervous ticks and blinks ceased on the instant. He stared at Gentle with a tiny smile on his face, as if he was used to being the butt of jokes and wanted to believe that this was one.
"No,"
he said.
"I'm afraid so," Gentle replied. "She was killed in the palace."
Floccus took off his glasses again and ran his thumb and middle finger from the bridge of his nose along his lower lids.
"That's grim," he said.
"She was a very brave woman."
"She was that."
"And she put up a very spirited defence, but we were outnumbered."
"How did you escape?"
Floccus asked, the inquiry innocent of accusation.
"That's a very long story," Gentle said, "and I don't think I'm quite ready to tell it yet."
"Which way are you heading?"
Dado said.
"Nicotimus told me you Dirthers have an encampment of some kind, at the margin of the first. Is that right?"
"Indeed we do."
"Then that's where I'm going. She said a man I knew, do you know Esterbrook, was healed there. I want to heal Pi."
"Then we'd best go together," Floccus said. "It's no use my waiting here any longer. Nicae's spirit will have passed by a long time ago."
"Do you have any kind of transport?"
"Indeed I do," he said, brightening. "A very fine car I found in the Caramess. It's parked over there."
He pointed through the crush.
"If it's still there," Gentle remarked.
"It's guarded,"
Dado said, with a grin.
"May I help you with the mischief?"
He put his arm beneath Pi, who had now lost consciousness completely. Then they started to make their way through the crowd, Dado shouting to clear the route ahead. His demands were almost entirely ignored until he started shouting,
"Rookash! Rookash!"
which had the desired effect of dividing the throng.
"What's Rookash?"
Gentle asked him.
"Contagious," Dado replied. "Not far now."
A few paces on and the vehicle came into view. Dado had good taste in loot. Not since that first glorious trip along the Patashokwa Highway had Gentle set eyes on a vehicle so sleek, so polished, or so wholly inappropriate for desert travel. It was powder blue with silver trim, its tyres white, its interior fur-lined. Sitting on the hood, its leash tied to one of the wing mirrors, was its guard and antithesis, an animal related to the Rajami, via the hyena, and boasting the least pleasant attributes of both. It was as round and lardy as a pig, but its back and flanks were covered with a coat of mottled fur. Its head was short-snouted but heavily whiskered. Its ears pricked like a dog's at the sight of Dado, and it set up a round of barks and squeals so high they made Dado sound basso profondo by contrast.
"Good girl! Good girl!" he said.
The creature was up on its stubby legs, shaking its rear in delight at its master's return. Its belly was laden with teats which shook to the rhythm of its welcome. Dado opened the door, and there on the passenger seat was the reason the creature was so defensive of the vehicle. A litter of five yapping offspring, perfect miniatures of their mother. Dado suggested Gentle and Pi take the back seat, while Mama Saishai, as he called her, sat with her children. The interior stank of the animals, but the previous owner had been fond of comfort, and there were cushions to support the mischief's head and neck. When Saishai herself was invited back into the vehicle, the stench increased tenfold, and she growled at Gentle in a less than friendly manner. But Dado placated her with baby talk, and she was soon curled up on the seat beside him, suckling her fat babes. With the travellers assembled, they headed off towards the mountains. Exhaustion claimed Gentle after a mile or two, and he slept, his head on Pi's shoulder. The road steadily deteriorated over the next few hours, and the discomfort of the journey repeatedly brought him up to the surface of sleep, with scraps of dreams clinging to him. They were not dreams of Isordarex, nor were they memories of the adventures he and Pi had shared on their travels across the Imagica. It was the fifth his mind was returning to in these fitful slumbers, shunning the horrors and the murders of the reconciled dominions for safer territory. Except that it wasn't safe any longer, of course. The man he'd been in that dominion, Klein's bastard boy, the lover and the faker, was a fabrication, and he could never return to that simple, sybaritic life again. He'd lived a lie, the scale of which even the most suspicious of his mistresses, Vanessa, whose abandoning of him had begun this whole endeavour, could never have imagined. And from that lie, three human spans of self-deceit had come. Thinking of Vanessa, he remembered the empty Mews house in London, and the desolation he'd felt, wandering it with nothing to show for his life but a string of broken romances, a few forged paintings, and the clothes he was wearing. It was laughable now, but that day he thought he could fall no further. Such naivete. He'd learned lessons in despair since then, numerous enough to fill a book, the bitterest reminder lying in wounded sleep beside him. Though it was distressing to conceive of losing Pi, he refused himself the indulgence of denying the possibility. He'd turned a blind eye on the unpalatable too often in the past, with catastrophic results. Now the facts had to be faced. The mischief was becoming frailer by the hour, its skin icy, its breath so shallow that on occasion it was barely discernible. Even if all that Nicetomas had said about the erasure's healing powers proved correct, there would be no miracle cure for such a profound malady. Gentle would have to go back to the fifth alone, trusting that Pi O'Pa would be fit enough to follow after a time. The longer he delayed that return, the less opportunity he'd have to muster assistance in the war against Sartori. That war would come, he had no doubt of it. The urge to conquer burned bright in his other, as it had perhaps once burned in him, until desire and luxury and forgetfulness had dimmed it. But where would he find such allies? Men and women who wouldn't laugh the way he'd have laughed 6 months before, when he started to talk about the dominion hopping he'd done and the jeopardy the world was in from a man with his face. Certainly he wouldn't find imaginations among his peer group supple enough to embrace the vistas he was returning to describe. They were fashionably disdainful of belief, having had the flesher's star-stuff hopes of youth dashed by midnight sweats and their morning reflection. The most he'd heard any of them confess to was a vague pantheism, and they'd deny even that when sober. Of them all, he'd only ever heard Clem espouse any belief in organized religion, and those dogmas were as antithetical to the message he was bringing from the Dominions as the tenets of a nihilist. Even if Clem could be persuaded from the communion rail to join Gentle, they would be an army of two against a maestro who had honed his powers until they could command dominions. There was one other possibility, and that was Judith. She would certainly not mock his wanderer's tales, but she'd been treated so heinously from the start of this tragedy that he dared not expect forgiveness from her, much less fellowship. Besides, who knew where her true sympathies lay? Though she might resemble Quasar to the last hair, she'd been made in the same bloodless womb that had produced the Autarch. Was she not therefore his spiritual sister? Not born, but made? If she had to choose between the butcher of Isordarex and those seeking to destroy him, could she be trusted to side with the destroyers, when their victory would mean she'd lose the only creature in the Imagica who shared her condition? Though she and Gentle had meant much to each other, who knew how many liaisons they'd enjoyed over the centuries, reigniting the desire which had brought them together in the first place, then parting again, forgetting they'd even met. He had to treat her with the utmost caution from this point on. She'd been innocent in the dramas of an earlier age, a toy in cruel and careless hands. But the woman she'd become over the decades was neither victim nor toy, and if, or perhaps when, she became aware of her past, she was perfectly capable of revenging herself upon the man who'd made her, however much she'd claimed to love him once. Seeing that his passenger was now awake, Flockus gave Gentle a progress report. They were making good time, he said. Within an hour they'd be in the mountains, on the other side of which the desert lay. "How long do you estimate to the erasure?" Gentle asked him.
"'We'll be there before nightfall,' Flockus promised. "'How's the mischief faring?'
"'Not well, I'm afraid.'
"'There'll be no cause to mourn,' Flockus said brightly. "'I've known people on death's door who were healed at the Eurasia. "'It's a place of miracles. "'But then everywhere is, if we just knew how to look. "'That's what Father Athanasius taught me. "'You were in prison with Athanasius, weren't you?'
"'I was never exactly imprisoned, not the way he was.
"'But you met him?'
"'Oh, yes, he was priest at our wedding.'
"'You and Mischief, you mean? You're married?'
he whistled.
"'Now you, sir, are what I call a lucky man. "'I've heard a lot about these Mischiefs, "'and I never heard of one getting married before. "'They're usually lovers. Heartbreakers.'
"'He whistled again.
"'Well, that's wonderful,' he said. "'We'll make sure she makes it, sir. "'Don't you worry. "'Oh, I'm sorry. She's not a she, is she? "'I've got to get that right. "'It's just that when I look at her, I mean it,' I see a she, you know? I suppose that's the wonder of them.
It's part of it.
Can I ask you something?
Ask away.
When you look at her, what do you see?
I've seen all kinds of things, Gentle replied. I've seen women. I've seen men. I've even seen myself.
But at the moment, Flockus said, what do you see right now?
Gentle looked at the mischief. I see Pi, he said. I see the face I love. Flockus made no reply to this, and after such gushing enthusiasm, Gentle knew there had to be some significance in his silence. What are you thinking? He asked.
Do you really want to know?
I do. We're friends, aren't we? At least getting that way. Tell me.
I was thinking it's not good you cared too much about the way she looks. The Erasure's no place to be in love with things as they are. People heal there, but they also change, you understand?
He took both hands off the wheel to make cupped palms, like scales.
There's got to be a balance, something given, something taken away.
What kind of changes? Gentle said.
Different from one to another, Flockus said. But you'll see for yourself very soon. When we get close to the First Dominion, nothing's quite as it seems.
Isn't that true of everything? Gentle said. The more I live, the less I seem to be certain about. Flockus's hands were back on the wheel, his burst of sunny talk suddenly overcast.
I don't think Father Athanasius ever talked about that, he said. Maybe he did. I don't remember everything he said.
The conversation ended there, leaving Gentle to wonder if in bringing the mischief back to the borders of the Dominion from which its people had been exiled, returning the great Transformer to a land in which transformation was a commonplace, he was undoing the knot Athanasius had tied in the cradle of Jessemet. 2. Jude had never been much impressed with architectural rhetoric, and she found nothing in the courtyards or corridors of the Autarch's palace to dissuade her from that indifference. There were some sights that put her in mind of natural splendours, smoke drifting across the forsaken gardens like morning mist, or clinging to the cold stone of the towers like cloud to a mountain spire. But such punnish pleasures were few. It was mostly bombast, everything built on a scale intended to be awe-inspiring, but to her eye, merely monolithic. She was glad when they finally reached Quaeswa's quarters, which for all their absurd ornamentation were at least humanized by their excesses, and they also heard there the first friendly voice in many hours, though its welcoming tones turned to horror when its owner, Quaeswa's many-tailed handmaiden, Concupiscentia, saw that her mistress had gained a twin and lost her eyes in the night she'd spent looking for salvation. Only after a good deal of lamentation could she be persuaded to tend to Quaeswa, which she did with trembling hands. The comet was by now making its steep ascent, and from Quaeswa's window Jude had a panoramic view of the desolation. She'd heard and seen enough in her short time here to realize that Isorderex had been ripe for the calamity that had overtaken it, and some in this city, perhaps many, had fanned the fire that had destroyed the Kesperates, calling it a just and cleansing flame. Even Peckable, who hadn't got an anarchist bone in his body, had intimated that his Isorderex's time had come.
but Jude still mourned its passing. This was the city she'd begged Oscar to show her, whose air had smelled so temptingly spicy, and whose warmth issuing from the retreat that day had seemed paradisiacal. Now she would return to the Fifth Dominion with its ash on her soles and its smuts in her nose, like a tourist back from Venice with pictures of bubbles in a lagoon.
"I'm so tired," Quasar said. "Will you mind if I sleep?"
"Of course not," Jude said.
"Is Sedux's blood still on the bed?" she asked Concupiscentia. "It is, ma'am." "Then I won't lie there, I think."
She put out her arm.
"Lead me to the little blue room. I'll sleep there. Judith, you should sleep too. Bathe and sleep. We've got so much to plan together."
"We do?"
"Oh, yes, sister," Quasar said. "But later."
She let Concupiscentia lead her away, leaving Jude to wander through the chambers which Quasar had occupied all her years of power. There was indeed a little blood on the sheets, but the bed looked tempting nevertheless, the scent off it dizzyingly strong. She refused its lush blandishments, however, and moved in search of a bathroom, anticipating another chamber of baroque excess. In fact, it proved to be the only room in the suite that came within shouting distance of restraint, and she happily lingered there, running a hot bath and soaking some of the ashes out of her body while contemplating her misty reflection in its black tiles. When she emerged, her skin tingling, the clothes she'd sloughed off, which were filthy and stinking, revolted her. She left them on the floor and instead, putting on the most subdued of the robes that lay scattered around the bedroom, took to the scented sheets. A man had been killed here only a few hours before, but that thought, which would once have driven her from the room, much less the bed, concerned her not at all. She didn't discount the possibility that this disinterest in the bed's sordid past was in part the influence of the scents off the pillow she laid her head upon. They conspired with fatigue and with the heat of the bath from which she'd risen to induce a languor she couldn't have resisted had her life depended upon it. The tension went from her sinews and joints. Her belly gave up its jitters. Closing her eyes, she let her sister's bed lull her into dreaming. Even during his most despondent meditations at the pivot pit, Sartori had never felt the emptiness of his condition as acutely as he did now that he was parted from his other. Meeting Gentle in the tower, and witnessing the pivot's call to reconciliation, he'd sensed new possibilities in the air, a marriage of self and self, which would heal him into wholeness. But Gentle had poured contempt on that vision, preferring his mischief spouse over his brother. Perhaps he'd change his mind now that Pai Opa was dead, but Sartori doubted it. If he were Gentle, and he was, the mischief's death would be obsessed upon and magnified until such time as it could be revenged. The enmity between them was confirmed. There'd be no reunion. He shared none of this with Rosengarten, who found him up in the gazebo guzzling chocolate and musing on his anguish. Nor did he allow Rosengarten to recount the disasters of the night, the generals dead, the army murdered or mutinied, for very long without stopping him. They had plans to lay together, he told the piebald man, and it was little use fretting over what was lost. "We're going to go to the Fifth, you and I," he informed Rosengarten. "We're going to build a new Isordarex." It wasn't often he'd won a response from the man, but he got one now. Rosengarten smiled.
"The Fifth?" he said.
"I knew it many years ago, of course. But by all accounts it's naked now. The maestros I knew are dead. Their wisdoms are dishonored, the place is defenceless. We'll take them with such sways they won't even know they've given up their dominion until the new Isordarex is in their hearts and inviolate." Rosengarten made a murmur of approval. "Make any farewells you have to make," Sartori said, "and I'll make mine."
"We're going now?"
"Before the fires are out," the autarch said. It was a strange sleep Jude fell into, but she'd travelled in the country of the unconscious often enough to feel unintimidated there. At this time she didn't move from the room in which she lay, but luxuriated in its excesses, rising and falling like the veils around the bed, and on the same smoky breeze. Once in a while she heard some sound from the courtyards far below, and allowed her eyes to flutter open, for the sheer lazy pleasure of closing them again, and once she was woken by the sound of Concupiscentia's reedy voice as she sang in a distant room. Though the words were incomprehensible, Jude knew it was a lament, full of yearning for things that had passed and could never be again. And she slipped back into sleep with the thought that sad songs were the same in any language, whether Gaelic, Navajo, or Potawatomi. Like the glyph of her body, this melody was essential, a sign that could pass between dominions. The music and the scent she lay upon were potent narcotics, and after a few melancholy verses of Concupiscentia's song, she was no longer sure whether she was asleep and hearing the lament in her dreams, or awake, but freed by Quaeswar's perfumes and wafted up into the folds of silks above her bed like a dreamer. Whichever it was, she scarcely cared. The sensations were pleasurable, and she'd had too little pleasure of late. Then came proof that this was indeed a dream. A doleful phantom appeared at the door and stood watching her through the veils. She knew him, even before he drew close to the bed. This was not a face she'd thought of much in recent times, so it was somewhat strange that she'd conjured him, but conjure him she had, and there was no denying the erotic charge she felt at his dreamed presence. It was gentle, perfectly remembered, his expression troubled the way it so often was, his hands stroking the veils as though they were her legs and could be parted with caresses.
"I didn't think you'd be here," he said to her.
His voice was raw and his expression as full of loss as Concupiscentia's song. "When did you come back?"
"A little while ago."
"You smell so sweet."
"I bathed."
"Looking at you like this, it makes me wish I could take you with me."
"Where are you going?"
"Back to the Fifth," he said. "I've come to say goodbye."
"From such a distance?" she said.
His face broke into an immoderate smile, and she remembered, seeing it, how easy seduction had always been for him, how women had slid their wedding rings off and their knickers down when he shone this way. But why be churlish? This was an erotic whimsy, not a trial. She dreamed that he saw the accusation in her eyes, however, and was begging her forgiveness.
"I know I've done you harm," he said.
"That's in the past," she replied magnanimously.
"Looking at you now..."
"Don't be sentimental," she said. "I don't want sentiment. I want you here."
Opening her legs, she let him see the niche she had for him. He didn't hesitate any longer, but pulled the veil aside and climbed onto the bed, wrenching the robe from her shoulders as he put his mouth against hers. For some reason, she'd conjured him tasting of chocolate. Another oddity, but not one that spoiled his kisses. She tugged at his clothes, but they were a dream invention, the dark blue fabric of his shirt, its laces and buttons in fetishistic profusion, covered in tiny scales, as though a family of lizards had shed their skins to clothe him. She was tender from the bath, and when he let his weight descend on her and began to work his body against hers, the scales pricked her stomach and breasts in the most arousing way. She wrapped her legs around him, and he acceded to her capture, his kisses becoming fiercer by the moment.
"The things we've done,"
he murmured as she kissed his face.
"The things we've done."
Her heart made her mind nimble. It leapt from memory to memory, back to the book she'd found in Esterbrook's flat all those months before, one of Oscar's gifts from the Dominions, a manual of sexual possibilities that had shocked her at the time. Images of its couplings appeared in her head now, intimacies that were perhaps only possible in the profligacy of sleep, unknitting both male and female and weaving them together again in new and ecstatic combinations. She put her mouth to her dream lover's ear and whispered to him that she forbade him nothing, that she wanted them to share the most extreme sensations they were capable of inventing. He didn't grin this time, which pleased her, but raised himself up on his hands, which were plunged into the downy pillows to either side of her head, and looked down at her with some of the same sadness he'd had on his face when he'd first arrived.
"One last time," he said.
"It doesn't have to be the last time," she said. "I can always dream you."
"And me you,"
he said, with the greatest fondness and courtesy. She reached down between their bodies and slipped off his belt, then pulled his trousers open with some violence, unwilling to be delayed by his buttons. What filled her hand was as silken as the fabric hiding it was rough, still only half engorged, but all the more entertaining for that. She stroked him. He sighed as he bent his head towards her, licking her lips and teeth, letting his chocolate-sweetened spittle run off his tongue into her mouth. She raised her hips and moved the groove of her sex against the underside of his erection, wetting it. He started to murmur to her terms of endearment, she presumed, though, like concupiscentious song, they were in no language she understood. They sounded as sweet as his spittle, however, and lulled her like a cradle song, as though to slip her into a dream within a dream. As her eyes closed, she felt him raise his hips, lifting the thickness of his sex from between her labia, and with one thrust, hard enough to stab the breath from her, he entered, dropping down on top of her as he did so. The endearments ceased. The kisses, too. He put one hand on her brow, his fingers laced into her hair, and the other at her neck, his thumb rubbing her windpipe and coaxing sighs from it. She'd forbidden him nothing and would not rescind that invitation simply because his possession of her was so sudden. Instead, she raised her legs and crossed them behind his back, then started to whip him on with insults. Was this the most he could give her? The deepest he could go? He wasn't hard enough, wasn't hot enough. She wanted more. His thrusts speeded up, his thumb tightening against her throat, but not so much it kept her from drawing breath and expelling it again in a fresh round of provocations. "I could fuck you forever," he said to her, his tone halfway between devotion and threat. "There's nothing I can't make you do. There's nothing I can't make you say. I could fuck you forever." This was not talk she would have welcomed from a flesh-and-blood lover, but in a dream it was arousing. She let him continue in the same mode, opening her arms and legs beneath him while he recited all that he would do to her, a litany of ambition that matched the rhythm of his hips. The room her dream had raised around them split here and there, and another seeped in through the cracks to occupy the same space, this one darker than Quasar's veil-draped chamber and lit by a fire that blazed off to her left. Her dream lover didn't fade, however. He remained with her and in her, more frenzied in his thrusts and promises than ever. She saw him above her as if lit by the same flames that warmed her nakedness, his face knotted and sweaty, his index of desires coming between clenched teeth. She would be his doll, his whore, his wife, his goddess. He would fill every hole of her forever and ever, own her, worship her, turn her inside out. Hearing this, she remembered the images in Estabrook's book again, and the memory made her cells swell as if each was a tiny bud ready to burst, their petals pleasure, their scent the shouts she was making, rising off her to roar fresh adoration from him. It came, cruel and exquisite by turns. One moment he wanted to be her prisoner, bound to her every whim, nourished on her shit and the milk he'd win from her breasts with suckling. The next she was less than the excrement he'd hungered for, and he was her only hope for life. He'd resurrect her with his fuck. He'd fill her with a fiery stream till her eyes were washed from her head and she drowned in him. There was more, but her cries of pleasure were mounting with every moment, and she heard less and less, saw less, too, closing her eyes against the mingled rooms, fire-lit and veiled, letting her head fill with the geometries that always attended pleasure, forms like her glyph unravelled and reworked. And then, just as she was reaching the first of the peaks, a range of stratospheric heights ahead, she felt him shudder and his thrusts stop. She didn't believe he'd finished. Not at first. This was a dream, and she'd conjured him to perform the way actualities never did, to go on when lovers of flesh and blood had spilled their promises and were panting their apologies beside her. He couldn't desert her now. She opened her eyes. The firelit chamber had gone, and the flames in Gentle's eyes had gone with it. He had already withdrawn, and all she felt between her legs was his fingers, dabbling in the dribble he'd supplied. He looked at her lazily. "You almost tempt me to stay," he said, "but I've got work to do."
Work? What work did dreams have besides the dreamer's commandments?
Don't leave,
she demanded. I'm done, he said. He was getting off the bed. She reached for him, but even in sleep the languor of the pillow was upon her, and he was away between the veils before her fingers came close to catching hold. She sank back in a slow swoon, watching his figure become remoter as the layers of gossamer between them multiplied. Stay beautiful, he told her. Maybe I'll come back for you when I've built the new Isorder X. This made little sense to her, but she didn't care. It was her own wretched invention and worthless. She let it go, the figure seeming to halt at the door as if for one backward glance, then disappearing altogether. Her mind had no sooner let him slip than it conjured a compensation, however. The veils at the bottom of the bed parted, and the many-tailed concupiscentia appeared, her eyes bright with craving. She didn't wait for any word to pass between them, but crawled up onto the bed, her gaze fixed on Judith's groin, her bluish tongue flicking as she approached. Jude raised her knees. The creature put her head down and began to lick out what the dream lover had left, her silky palms caressing Jude's thighs. The sensation soothed her, and she watched through the slits of her drugged eyes as concupiscentia bathed her clean. Before she'd finished, the dream grew dimmer, and the creature was still at its caressing work when another veil descended. This so dense, she lost both sight and sensation in its folds.
Chapter 4 1 Like galleons turned to the desert wind and in full sail before it, the tents of the Dirthers presented a pretty spectacle from a distance. But Gentle's admiration turned to awe as the car drew closer and their scale became apparent. They were the height of 5-story houses and more, billowing towers of ochre and scarlet fabric, the colours all the more vivid given that the desert floor, which had been sand-coloured at the outset, was now almost black, and the heavens they rose against were grey, being the wall between the Second Dominion and the unknown world haunted by Hapaxamendios. Flockus halted the car a quarter of a mile from the perimeter of the encampment.
I should go ahead, he said, and explain who we are and what we're doing here.
Make it quick, Gentle told him.
Flockus was away like a gazelle over ground that was no longer sand, but a flinty carpet of stone shards, like the clippings from some stupendous sculpture. Gentle looked at the mischief, lying in his arms as if in a charmed sleep, its brow innocent of frowns. He stroked its cold cheek. How many friends and loved ones must he have seen pass away in the 2 centuries and more of his life on Earth? Though he'd wiped those griefs from his conscious mind, could he doubt they'd made their mark, fueling his terror of sickness and hardening his heart over the years? Perhaps he'd always been a philanderer and plagiarist, a master of counterfeited emotion. But was that so surprising in a man who knew in his gut that the drama, however soul-searing, was cyclic? The faces changed and changed, but the story remained essentially the same. As Klein had been fond of pointing out, there was no such thing as originality. It had all been said before, suffered before. If a man knew that, was it any wonder love became mechanical and death just a scene to be shunned? There was no absolute knowledge to be gained from either. Just another ride on the merry-go-round, another blurred scene of faces smiling and faces grieved. But his feelings for the mischief had been no sham, and with good reason. In Pye's self-denials, I'm nothing and nobody, it had said at the beginning, he'd heard an echo of the anguish he himself felt. And in Pye's gaze, so heavy with the freight of years, seen a comrade soul who understood the nameless pain he carried. It had stripped him of his shams and chicanery and given him a taste of the maestro he'd been and might be again. There was good to be done with such power, he now knew, breaches to be healed, rights to be restored, nations to be roused and hopes reawakened. He needed his inspiration beside him if he was to be a great reconciler.
I love you, Pye, O Pa, he murmured.
Gentle!
The voice was Flockus's, calling him from outside the window.
I've seen Athanasius. He says we're to come straight in.
Good, good. Gentle threw open the door.
Do you want help?
No, I'll carry Pi. He got out, then reached back into the car and picked up the mischief.
Gentle, you do understand that this is a sacred place?
Flockus said as he led the way towards the tents.
No singing, dancing, or farting, huh? Don't look so pained, Flockus. I understand.
As they approached, Gentle realized that what he'd taken to be an encampment of closely gathered tents was in fact a continuum, the various pavilions with their swooping roofs joined by smaller tents to form a single golden beast of wind and canvas. Inside its body, the gusts kept everything in motion. Tremors moved through even the most tautly erected walls, and in the heights of the roof, swaths of fabric whirled like the skirts of dervishes, giving off a constant sigh. There were people up among the folds, some walking on webs of rope as if they were solid board, others sitting in front of immense windows opened in the roof, their faces turned to the wall of the first world, as though they anticipated a summons out of that place at any moment. If such a summons came, there'd be no hectic rush. The atmosphere was as measured and soothing as the motion of the dancing sails above.
Where do we find the doctor? Gentle asked Flockus.
There is no doctor, he replied. Follow me. We've been given a place to lay the mischief down.
There must be some kind of medical attendance.
There's fresh water and clothes, maybe some laudanum and the like. But Pi's beyond that.
The Yorido won't be dislodged with medications. It's the proximity of the First Dominion that'll heal it.
Then we should go outside right now, he said. Get Pi closer to the erasure.
Any closer than this would take more resilience than either you or I possess, Gentle, Flockus said. Now follow me, and be respectful of this place.
He led Gentle through the beast's tremulous body to a smaller tent, where a dozen plain, low beds were set, some occupied, most not. Gentle laid the mischief down in one and proceeded to unbutton its shirt, while Flockus went in search of cool water for its now burning skin, and some sustenance for Gentle and himself. While he waited, Gentle examined the spread of the Yorido, which was too extensive to be fully examined without stripping Pi completely, which he was loath to do with so many strangers in the vicinity. The mischief had been covetous of its privacy. It had been many weeks before Gentle had glimpsed its beauty naked, and he wanted to respect that modesty, even in Pi's present condition. In fact, very few of those who passed by even glanced their way, and after a time he began to feel the fear lose its grip on him. There was very little more that he could do. They were at the edge of the known dominions, where all maps stopped and the enigma of enigmas began. What use was fear in the face of such imponderables? He had to put it aside and proceed with dignity and containment, trusting to the powers that occupied the air here. When Flockus returned with the means to wash Pi, Gentle asked if he might be left alone to do so.
Of course, Flockus replied. I've got friends here. I'd like to seek them out.
When he left, Gentle began to bathe the suppurating eruptions of the Yorido, which oozed not blood, but a silvery pus, the smell of which pricked his sinuses like ammonia. The body it fed upon seemed not only enfeebled, but somehow unfocused, as though its contours and musculature were about to become a vapor and the flesh disperse. Whether this was the Yorido's doing or simply the condition of a mischief when life, and therefore its capacity to shape the sight of those gazing upon it, was fading, Gentle didn't know, but it made him think back over the way this body had appeared to him. As Judith, of course, as an assassin armoured in nakedness, and as the loving androgyne of their wedding night in the cradle, that had momentarily taken his face and stared back at him like a prophecy of Sartori. Now, finally, it seemed to be a form of burnished mist, receding from his hand even as he touched it.
Gentle, is that you? I didn't know you could see in the dark.
Gentle looked up from Pi's body to find that in the time he'd been washing the mischief, half mesmerized by memory, the evening had fallen. There were lights burning at the bedsides of those nearby, but none near Pi or Pa. When he returned his gaze to the body he'd been washing, it was barely discernible in the gloom.
I didn't know I could either.
He stood up to greet the newcomer. It was Athanasius, a lamp in his hand. By its flame, which was as subject to the wind's whim as the canvas overhead, Gentle saw he'd been wounded in the fall of his Ordurex. There were several cuts on his face and neck, and a larger, livid injury on his belly. For a man who'd celebrated Sundays by making himself a new crown of thorns, these were probably welcome discomforts.
"I'm sorry I didn't come to welcome you earlier," he said, "but with such numbers of casualties coming in, I spend a lot of time administering last rites."
Gentle didn't remark on this, but the fear crept back up his spine.
"We've had a lot of the Autark soldiers find their way here, and that makes me nervous. I'm afraid we'll let in someone on a suicide mission, and he'll blow the place apart. That's the way the bastard thinks. If he's destroyed, he'll want to bring everything down with him."
"I'm sure he's much more concerned with making his getaway," Gentle said.
"Where can he go? The word's already spread across the Imagica. There's armed uprising in Patashokwa. There's hand-to-hand combat on the Lenten Way. Every dominion's shaking, even the First."
"The First? How?"
"Haven't you seen?" "No, obviously you haven't. Come with me."
Gentle glanced back towards Pi.
"The mist is safe here," Athanasius said. "We won't be long."
He led Gentle through the body of the beast to a door that took them out into the deepening dusk. Though Flaccus had counseled against what they were doing, hinting that the Erasure's proximity could do harm, there was no sign of any consequence. He was either protected by Athanasius or resistant to any malign influence on his own account. Either way, he was able to study the spectacle laid before him without ill effect. There was no wall of fog, or even deeper twilight to mark the division between the Second Dominion and the haunt of Hapex Amendius. The desert simply faded away into nothingness, like a drawing erased by the power on the other side, first becoming unfocused, then losing its colour and its detail. This subtle removal of solid reality, the world wiped away and replaced with nothing, was the most distressing sight Gentle had ever set eyes on. Nor was the similarity between what was happening here and the state of Pi's body lost on him.
"You said the Erasure was moving," Gentle whispered.
Athanasius scanned the emptiness, looking for some sign, but nothing caught his eye.
"It's not constant," he said, "but every now and then ripples appear in it."
"Is that rare?"
"There are accounts of this happening in earlier times, but this isn't an area that encourages accurate study. Observers get poetic here. Scientists turn to sonnets, sometimes literally."
He laughed.
"That was a joke, by the way. Just in case you start worrying about your legs rhyming."
"How does looking at this make you feel?" Gentle asked him.
"Afraid," Athanasius said. "Because I'm not ready to be there."
"Nor am I," Gentle said. "But I'm afraid Pi is. I wish I'd never come, Athanasius. Maybe I should take Pi away now while I still can."
"That's your decision," Athanasius replied. "But I don't believe the mischief will survive if you move it. A Eurydo's a terrible poison, Gentle. If there's any chance of Pi being healed, it's here, close to the First."
Gentle looked back towards the distressing absence of the Erasure.
"Is going to nothing being healed?" he said.
"It seems more like death to me."
"They may be closer than we think, death and healing," Athanasius said.
"I don't want to hear that," Gentle said.
"Are you staying out here?"
"For a while," Athanasius replied. "If you do decide to go, come and find me first, will you? So that we can say goodbye."
"Of course."
He left Athanasius to his void watching and went back inside, thinking as he did so that this would be a fine time to find a bar and order up a stiff drink. As he started back in the direction of Pi's bed, he was brought to a halt by a voice too abrasive for this hallowed place, and sufficiently slurred to suggest the speaker had found a bar himself and drunk it dry.
"Gentle, you old bugger!"
Estabrook stepped into view, grinning expansively, though several of his teeth were missing.
"I heard you were here, and I didn't believe it." He seized Gentle's hand and shook it. "But here you are, large as life. Who'd have thought it, eh? The two of us, here."
Life in the encampment had wrought its changes on Charlie. He could scarcely have been further from the grief-wasted plotter Gentle had met on Kite Hill. Indeed, he could almost have passed for a clown, with his motley of pinstripe trousers, tattered braces, and unbuttoned tunic dyed half a dozen colours, all crowned with bald head and gap-toothed smile.
"It's so good to see you,"
he kept saying, his pleasure unalloyed. "We must talk. This is the perfect time. They're all going outside to meditate on their ignorance, which is fine for a few minutes, but God, it gets drab. Come with me, come on. They've given me a little nook of my own to keep me out of the way."
"Maybe later," Gentle said. "I've got a friend here who's sick."
"I heard somebody talking about that. A mistiff, is that the word?"
"That's the word."
"They're extraordinary, I heard. Very sexy. Why don't I come and see the patient with you?"
Gentle had no wish to keep Estabrook's company for longer than he needed to, but suspected that the man would beat a hasty retreat as soon as he set eyes on Pye, and realized the creature he'd come to gawk at was the same he'd hired to assassinate his wife. They went back to Pye's bedside together. Flockus was there with a lamp and an ample supply of food. Mouth crammed, he rose to be introduced, but Estabrook barely noticed him. His gaze was on Pye, whose head was turned away from the brightness of the lamp in the direction of the First Dominion.
"You lucky bugger," he said to Gentle. "She's beautiful."
Flockus glanced at Gentle to see if he intended to remark on Estabrook's error in sexing the patient, but Gentle made a tiny shake of his head. He was surprised that Pye's power to respond to the gaze of others was still intact, especially as his eyes saw an altogether more distressing sight. The substance of his beloved growing more insubstantial as the hours passed. Was this a sight and understanding reserved for maestros? He knelt beside the bed and studied the fading features on the pillow. Pye's eyes were roving beneath the lids.
"Dreaming of me?" Gentle murmured.
"Is she getting better?"
Estabrook inquired.
"I don't know," Gentle said. "This is supposed to be a healing place, but I'm not so sure."
"I really think we should talk," Estabrook said,
with the strained nonchalance of a man who had something vital to impart, but was not able to do so in present company.
"Why don't you pop along with me and have a quick drink? I'm sure Flockus will come and find you if anything untoward happens."
Flockus chewed on, nodding in accord with this, and Gentle agreed to go, hoping Estabrook had some insight into conditions here that would help him to decide whether to go or stay.
"I'll be 5 minutes," he promised Flockus,
and let Estabrook lead him off through the lamp-lit passages to what he'd earlier called his nook. It was off the beaten track somewhat, a little canvas room he'd made his own with what few possessions he'd brought from Earth. A shirt, its bloodstains now brown, hung above the bed like the tattered standard from some noteworthy battle. On the table beside the bed, his wallet, his comb, a box of matches, and a roll of mints had been arranged along several symmetrical columns of change into an altar to the spirit of the pocket.
"It's not much," Estabrook said, "but it's home."
"Are you a prisoner here?"
Gentle said as he sat in the plain chair at the bottom of the bed.
"Not at all," Estabrook said.
He brought a small bottle of liquor out from under the pillow. Gentle recognized it from the hours he and Hussar had lingered in the cafe in the OK to noon. It was the fermented sap of a swamp flower from the Third Dominion, Klaupo. Estabrook took a swig from the bottle, reminding Gentle of how he'd supped brandy from a flask on Kite Hill. He'd refused the man's liquor that day, but not now.
"I could go any time I wanted to," he went on, "but I think to myself, where would you go, Charlie? And where would I go?"
"Back to the Fifth?"
"In God's name, why?"
"Don't you miss it? Even a little?"
"A little, maybe. Once in a while I get maudlin, I suppose, and then I get drunk. Drunker. And I have dreams."
"Of what?"
"Mostly childhood things, you know. Odd little details that wouldn't mean a damn thing to anyone else."
He reclaimed the bottle and drank again.
"But you can't have the past back. So what's the use of breaking your heart? When things are gone, they're gone."
Gentle made a non-committal noise.
"You don't agree."
Not necessarily.
Name one thing that stays.
I don't...
No, go on. Name one thing.
Love.
Ha! Well, that certainly brings us full circle, doesn't it? Love. You know, I'd have agreed with you half a year ago. I can't deny that. I couldn't conceive of ever being out of love with Judith. But I am. When I think back to the way I felt about her, it seems ludicrous. Now, of course, it's Oscar's turn to be obsessed by her. First you, then me, then Oscar. But he won't survive long.
What makes you say that?
He's got his fingers in too many pies. It'd lend in tears, you see if it doesn't. You know about the tabula rasa, I suppose.
No.
Why should you? Esterbrook replied. You were dragged into this, weren't you? I feel guilty about that, I really do. Not that my feeling guilty is going to do either of us much good, but I want you to know I never understood the ramifications of what I was doing. If I had, I swear I'd have left Judith alone.
I don't think either of us would have been capable of that, Gentle remarked.
Leaving her alone? No, I don't suppose we would. Our paths were already beaten for us, eh? I'm not saying I'm a total innocent, mind you. I'm not. I've done some pretty wretched things in my time, things I squirm to think about. But compared with a tabula rasa, or a mad bastard like Sartori, I'm not so bad. And when I look out every morning into God's nowhere...
Is that what they call it?
Oh, hell no, they're much more reverential. That's my little nickname. But when I look out at it, I think, well, it's going to take us all one of these days, whoever we are. Mad bastards, lovers, drunkards. It's not going to pick and choose. We'll all go to nothing sooner or later. And, you know, maybe it's my age, but that doesn't worry me any longer. We all have our time, and when it's over, it's over.
There must be something on the other side, Charlie, Gentle said. Esterbrook shook his head.
That's all guff, he said. I've seen a lot of people get up and walk into the erasure, praying and carrying on. They take a few steps and they're gone. It's like they'd never lived.
But people are healed here. You were.
Oscar certainly made a mess of me, and I didn't die. But I don't know whether being here had much to do with that. Think about it. If God really was on the other side of that wall, and he was so damn eager to heal the sick, don't you think he'd reach out a little further and stop what's going on in his Ordrex? Why would he put up with horrors like that right under his nose? No, Gentle. I call it God's nowhere, but that's only half right. God isn't there. Maybe he was, once.
He trailed away and filled the silence with another throatful of Klaupo. Thank you for this, Gentle said.
What is there to thank me for?
You've helped me to make up my mind about something.
My pleasure, Esterbrook said. It's damn difficult to think straight, isn't it, with this bloody wind blowing all the time? Could you find your way back to that lovely lady of yours, or shall I go with you?
I'll find my way, Gentle replied. 2. He rapidly regretted declining Esterbrook's offer, discovering after turning a few corners that one lamplit passageway looked much like the next, and that not only could he not retrace his steps to Pye's bedside, he couldn't be certain of finding his way back to Esterbrook either. One route he tried brought him into a kind of chapel, where several dearthers were kneeling facing a window that gave onto God's nowhere. The erasure presented in what was now total darkness the same blank face it had by dusk, lighter than